Last week, we discussed the fact that although Moshe Feinstein had permitted the use of Welch's, of grape juice, which was manufactured completely automatically and pasteurized in the process, in fact, the custom over the last 30 or 40 years was to go against this particular decision, even though to me it seems to be a very logical decision. After the shiur last week, then he said that his father remembered a conversation that I had with the Rav on the subject. I don't remember this conversation, so I can't quote it from my own personal memory, but you said that your father said that basically the Rav agreed with Moshe Feinstein.
Yeah, I don't believe those words, but it was, he ended up in the same place.
Right. Okay. Nevertheless, that heter did not persist. Whether or not what the custom was in before the 1960s, you report that your parents refused to drink. But today, my question was whether people were drinking non-kosher grape juice. But there was no kosher grape juice, I remember. Well, right. But also one has to take into account that all kinds of juice were not common beverages before the end of the Second World War. So in any event, we can see that sometimes, even though there's a pretty convincing legal decision, it does not necessarily carry the day. In this particular case, if you want to say Rabbi Frank's negative decision carried the day, that's possible, but the decision was hard to justify logically, and I doubt that it had much effect in the United States anyway. The major effect was the taboo, or however you want to call it, against the INSF extending to grape juice, and of course also the marketing of canned grape juice, which is something that had not been available.
Rabbi Frank lived in Israel.
Rabbi Frank lived
in Israel. So it didn't really affect anybody,
Right, it did not affect anyone.
Well, are there people who go according to Rabbi Feinstein?
What do you mean, other people?
Are there people who go by this?
We don't use it in this house because we're afraid of what would happen if someone came into the house. not so much Lashon Hara, that they would not eat in our house.
Oh, I thought you meant people looking for their
But what Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik is claiming here is that there were certain unintended consequences of the law of the laws of the INSF. And also, as I say, I mean, for example, in our own time, in the United States, for example, tolerance is considered a virtue. That is, we live in a live and let live society, and not only is tolerance a virtue, but also varied cultures are considered a virtue. So that,
apropos, I saw Tropicana blended orange juice.
Yes.
Has grape juice in there.
Right.
And it has a hexa.
Well, then they must.
The Frank, okay.
Okay.
So I'm really wondering whether he goes to court,
whether he relies on Rabbi Feinstein or actually there's a supervision of what kind of grape juice they install. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. Mentioning it,
but grape juice, okay. So, as I said, cultural diversity is regarded as a virtue. I mean, tolerance never was a virtue in the monotheistic religions, because if you're in possession of the truth, then obviously it would be not a virtue to tolerate people who said that 2 + 2 = 5, for example. We would be offended, for instance, if the Catholic school would teach the denigration of the Jewish religion in their school system. And yet here, we have instituted, in the Maimonides school, a prayer which teaches the children 3 times a day that all other religions are full of nonsense. In other words, we've somehow or other instituted the saying of Shehem Mishtacharim Lahevel Varechu Mispalalim El El Lo Yoshia, which very clearly says that the other religions that are around here are full of baloney, and whereas for adults who may be saying this prayer, they can choose to say it or not say it, but the children in the school are learning a vicious form of religious intolerance simply inculcated.
But isn't that a quote taken from the being?
It's a quote taken. I don't want to go into this in detail.
Idol worship is.
It's a quote taken from Yeshayahu, and in that context, it refers to idolatry.
Sorry.
It was part of the original liturgy of Aleinu as it was recited in Musaf in Rosh Hashanah. When the Aleinu moved from being only said in the Musaf and Rosh Hashanah to becoming part of the daily prayer, it became undoubtedly part of the daily prayer. And
has been eliminated from all of the Sidurim in the last couple of hundred years precisely because of the...
Except Oslo.
It was eliminated whether by decree of the church or by fear of its reactions to it. The fact is that none of us here in the United States said this on a daily basis. And it is true that Rabbi Soloveitchik put it into the Musaf prayer, reinstituted it, because that was part of the original text. But it was certainly never said during Rabbi Soloveitchik's lifetime as part of the daily recital. Now, there's no doubt that the person who decided to reinstitute it was acting in the best of interests, because he thought that this is what the text actually says, and why not revert to the actual text? But a consequence of this is that, in fact, we're teaching intolerance to young children three times a day, and for no reason other than the fact that we're so-called following Rabbi Soloveitchik's principle of restoring the original text to the prayers.
I thought it referred to pagans.
There are no pagans around here in the United States.
No, there are not. So
why don't we say that it's...
They don't, huh?
Oh, they're Buddhists.
Why don't we just say it's part of the
prayer? Because of the fact that...
We can say it because it's an obscenity.
I don't know if it's an obscenity. It's certainly, for the children to learn it every day, three times a day, inculcates a form of intolerance. And you may be supple enough to realize that maybe we should say Shehem Hishtachavu, referring to the idolaters, but they're not many. There's some, we see them in Chinatown, but they're not many idolaters around in the United States. And therefore, I'm simply saying that you can make a decision based purely on an intellectual matter, restoring the original form of the prayer, and maybe even give it an interpretation that's not particularly obnoxious, but the effect can be damaging.
Apply the Confederate flag.
Yeah. What? Thank you. Of course they're paying attention because they have to stress this particular sentence precisely because it's not in the standard prayer book.
But do you know how it's explained to the children? Maybe it's explained to them that this refers to idolatry and it isn't. No, that isn't explained
that
it refers to Christianity.
Okay, I want to simply use that as an example. I simply want to use that as an example where sometimes there can be some unintended consequences of a decision which was made on a purely textual or other basis. Now, as we know, Here is the main thesis of Rabbi Soloveitchik's book, and it's fairly interesting, and you have to decide for yourself whether it's convincing or not. His point was, as we know, the original reason for the prohibition against wine which a non-Jew touched was because of the fact that there was a presumption of libation. Libation was common both in Persia and within the Roman Empire. And therefore, the fact that a non-Jew touched the wine led you to suspect that he may have performed an act of libation, and therefore that wine was prohibited b'hana'ah. That is, one was not only not allowed to drink it, but one was not allowed to derive any benefit from it.
What is that? Is it a prayer over?
It's pouring, making an act of sacrifice to the gods. You're pouring out a little bit to the gods as part of them.
So what they do with the wine contaminates the whole bottle.
What they do with the wine contaminates the wine that they touch. Physical touching. We're talking about physical contact between the
liquid itself. Not with the container.
Not with the container, with the liquid itself, but then there's a whole long series of technical laws which we will may or may not go into great detail about as to what kind of contact, second order contact, like touching the thing with a stick or with a straw or something like that, whether that contaminates the wine, makes it prohibited or not. So the principal prohibition was one of libation. A secondary prohibition, which didn't enter too much into the thinking of the Rishonim until the 12th century, was avoidance of social intercourse. That various foodstuffs, including wine, were prohibited in order to avoid social intercourse. And what Rabbi Soloveitchik is saying in this book is that this became a taboo in the sense that it became prohibited above and beyond, it inculcated itself into the consciousness of the Jewish people in the sense that it became prohibited even above and beyond where the laws necessarily prohibited it. And I just wanted to introduce this whole business with great Jews as an illustration of where that can happen. On the other hand,
as we know, we need wine for Kiddush and Havdalah and other things. And the only way that Jews could therefore obtain this wine was to have their own vineyards and grow their own wine and press their own grapes, or at least buy the grapes and press their own grapes. And in fact, they obtained a certain amount of expertise in winemaking and in wine growing and in the production of grapes, simply because they needed it for their own purposes. This was especially true in the northern climes, because the grape is a subtropical fruit originally, and therefore you needed to know exactly where to plant it, how to water it, which were the good varieties and so on. So it was not just simply a matter of putting a plant in the ground and forgetting about it. It required a great deal of technical expertise, which Jews acquired simply because they had to be able to produce their own wine. Then, all of this time, that is up through the 8th or the 9th century, this was just a small-time operation. But in the 9th, 10th, and 11th century, especially with the resurgence of European economic activity in the 11th century, the wine trade became a major operation. That is, wine export, not Jewish wine, the wine export in general became a major transaction. It was the principal mode of business, the principal industry in the Rhineland and elsewhere where the Jews were settled. And the Jews could not directly own the vineyards or employ non-Jewish workers in order to produce this wine. So they couldn't be directly involved in the wine business because of the prohibition of the Ayin Nesach. And the claim is that they became involved in this business as investors. That is, instead of directly owning the vineyards or producing the wine themselves, they lent the money to the vintners, is that the word, who would produce the wine. So the Jews were, in fact, heavily involved in the wine business, but indirectly, as lending the money, being the investors, but not being the actual owners. This drew the Jews into the money-lending business in the 11th and 12th century. They weren't particularly in that business prior to that time. They were mainly engaged in Europe. They were mainly engaged in international trade, or sometimes with the local trade, and in Babylon they were still engaged in agriculture. So, and then this involvement of the Jews into the money lending business also got them into the small time money lending business, such as pawnbroking and so on, and this of course led to an increase in the already existing anti-Semitism, and was a component in, and especially when the Jews were evicted because of anti-Semitic rules from ownership of land and property and from being involved in trade and other items, the only thing that was left to them as business was money lending, either on the large or the small scale. And small scale money lending, when they're charging large interest to people who may or may not pay back their loans, pawnbroking and stuff like that, of course, led to an increase in the already existing hatred of the Christians for the Jews. So one of the unintended consequences of this whole event was the change in the character of anti-Semitism prior to the 11th and 12th century and what happened after the 12th century. So that's one of the main theses in this book, and it may be worthwhile to explain what I mean by three stages in anti-Semitism, and for that there is what I think is quite a good book toward a definition of anti-Semitism. You could say that some Persians, Greeks, and Romans, who had their own social and cultural identity, hated the Jews in their midst because of a real Jewish characteristic, that is, the Jews' insistence on maintaining their Jewish identity as a separate people. So the classical anti-Semitism, it could be construed as a kind of xenophobia, just simply the hatred of the other, and in particular the hatred of a minority that persisted in maintaining its own identity and not adopting the mores or the beliefs of the majority. It is important to note, however, that the cultures that gave those Persians, Greeks, and Romans their sense of cosmic and social identity had developed independently of Judaism and had no Jewish components. Consequently, those who identified with those cultures could hate or ridicule Jews without feeling any threat other than the fact of difference to the foundations of their own sense identity. though they hated the Jews for what they were doing or not doing, they had no need to examine seriously the beliefs of Judaism or try to demonstrate their errors. Their anti-Jewish hostility differed little from any other instances of ethnocentric hostility throughout history. On the other hand, with the advent of Christianity, the situation changed pretty drastically. Like many non-Christians before them, Christians were anti-Judaic, that is, they were acting to real characteristics of Jews and Judaism. The Christian anti-Semitism, and now I'm referring to Christian anti-Semitism in the broad sweep as it existed from the advent of Christianity and the triumph of Christianity in the 4th century up to the 10th or 11th century, but Christian anti-Semitism differed markedly from that of non-Christians because the Christian sense of identity forced them to come to grips with Judaism. Since their sense of identity had so many Jewish components, the Christians had to think about the Christians could not simply dismiss Judaism as wrong or irrelevant. To assert the distinctiveness and superiority of their own identity, Christians had to think about Judaism and argue amongst themselves and with Jews that Christians were right and Jews wrong. Thus, for Christians, the ability of Jews to maintain their own identity was not only annoying or hateful in the way ethnic differences so often are, it was an intimate and enduring threat to their sense of identity, a challenge built into their own religion. The challenge was difficult, and Christian leaders, starting with Paul, devoted much energy to meeting it. Their labors produced something new, the first systematically elaborated rationalization that justified hostility to Jews. By the beginning of the 5th century, the Christian anti-Judaic doctrine that depicted Jews as reprehensible, wrong even in their own terms, indeed internally damned, was firmly established. It would be preached ever more widely and endure with little change for centuries. Christian anti-Semitism thus seemed an important precondition for European anti-Semitism, a halfway station between a very common kind of ethnocentric hostility and the peculiarly irrational hostility of Hitler. And if, like many Christian scholars, but for my own reasons, I want to distinguish it from anti-Semitism, I have to clarify my thinking about its nature and its consequences. But then, on top of this new Christian form of anti-Semitism, which incorporated anti-Semitism in their fundamental beliefs, something strange happened in the 11th century. Before the 12th century, Jews were neither unusually prominent in money-lending were stereotyped as moneylenders. By 1150, however, Jews in Northern Europe becoming disproportionately involved in moneylending, and the new stereotype of the Jews as usurers began to appear in Northern Europe. What made Jewish moneylending possible was not religious attitudes, it was the economic advance that started in the late 10th century, and the new demand for credit is stimulated, which was satisfied by monasteries, urban Christian lenders, and Jews, and the efforts of secular rulers to profit from it and the effect of their efforts on Jews. Since Jews were already damned, secular authorities were, for purely material reasons, quite willing to support Jewish money lending energetically, so long as they could exploit it without political repercussions. Thanks above all to that support, and deprived of other opportunities, Jews engaged more and more in money lending. They did so even though many debtors disliked or hated their creditors, and even though Christian ecclesiastical authorities were condemning ever more stridently the kind of credit transactions in which Jews typically engaged. Credit was so needed that even though Christians were the major source of credit, Jewish moneylenders could also profit so long as they were supported and not overly exploited by the secular authority. But the ultimate price was high. Since Christians did not want to acknowledge their own involvement in moneylending openly, it served many interests to emphasize the role of Jews and stereotype Jews as the archetypal usurers. The intersection of religious and material interests made Jews seem even more evil. Their fundamentally evil nature found expression not only in their killing of Christ, but also in their addiction to usury. So one of the components that changed in the 11th century was the entrance of Jews into moneylending, and one of Professor Soloveitchik's points is that this came via a heavy investment in the wine trade, where they couldn't own the lands outright, but had to. They couldn't own them because of
authority.
No, they couldn't own them because of the INS Act laws.
Why wouldn't that allow them?
Because you're not allowed to derive any profit enough from Stam Yena. So, because this was so an unintended consequence, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, of the prohibition of the Ayin Esser, was that the Jews had to engage in a legal fiction of not outright owning the land, but actually lending money to the people that owned the land. And via that passageway, they moved on into money lending.
Didn't we reach the goal a number of years ago? They basically got to the point where you could make the tailoring for the church that was supposed to have a meeting. So you could do that.
Well, so the issue...
Owning
issue
the land seems to be very far from how the options from here.
No, it's not owning the land. It's owning the whole wine production.
Owning the wine, owning the wine.
You're producing
owning
the wine.
Yes, but owning the
it's not the issue of owning the land as such. It's the production of the wine, which they couldn't do.
Well, why couldn't they just hire Jews to do it?
They're not that many Jews. They're a very small minority. This is a major industry. We required many, many workers. In fact, one of the major problems, as we will see, that they had to overcome was even in the household. Since they couldn't provide enough Jewish servants, there had to be non-Jewish servants in the household, and inevitably they came into contact with wine, so they had to deal with that problem as well. Rabbi Soloveitchik's point in all of this is that these halachic problems were not answered.
The Jews never go for the blue car of college.
That's what they were doing. They were setting up straw companies, but that in those times, since the concept of corporation or something like that didn't exist, that meant they were investing. They were pretending to be
they were reaping the rewards, but
they were being capitalists, but in the guise of being bankers. That's essentially the point. So that's one of the transitions from religious anti-Semitism to what we might call crazy anti-Semitism, which existed from the 11th century until the present and continues to this day. And it goes above and beyond simply the fact that you believe that the Jews killed your God, but also that they're sons of the devil, they drink Christian blood, they perform sacrifices, and so on. So this is what Professor Langley writes. Again, part four, I'm reading from the introduction of his book. Part four is devoted to that new kind of exploitation, which might be called psychological or irrational exploitation. These chapters describe how Christians came to believe that Jews committed ritual murder. They are the empirical core of my argument about the emergence of anti-Semitism. They examine the new irrational exploitation of the existence of Jews that was expressed by a new kind of belief about them and a new kind of hostility towards them. To repress their own doubts, some Christians now imagine that contemporary Jews engaged in evil conduct that could not be seen. The old anti-Judaic accusations against Jews always had an obvious kernel of truth, however exaggerated. Though Jews placed a different value on the conduct, it was certainly true that Jews did not understand their scripture as Christians understood the Old Testament, did not believe in the divinity of Jesus, and approved of his execution, displayed their contempt in Christianity and its sacred symbols openly whenever it was safe, and were disproportionately engaged in money-lending in Northern Europe by the latter 12th century. About 1150, just when a new kind of Christian doubt had appeared, when Jews were becoming disproportionately involved in money-lending, and when they were being assigned a legal status that set them apart as inferior to all Christians, beliefs appeared that lacked any kernel of truth, that served to buttress Christian beliefs against the menace of new doubts. Anti-Semitism, by my definition, was emerging. To protect their threatened beliefs, some troubled Christians created irrational fantasies that Jews ritually crucified young children, engaged in ritual cannibalism. The doubts were that there were... Remember, part of the Christian dogma was, for example, that the wafer and the wine that are part of the communion become actually Christ's body and blood.
It's not established the Pope.
It was believed, but what you're reporting about is the Papal declaration that this had to be an actual, honest, and had to be an item of belief. In 1215, indeed, the Pope issued an edict saying that you had to believe this. But of course, that meant that there were people who were not believing. That is, the edict came into response to this peculiar dogma, which says that you can't just simply say that the wine is represents the blood of Christ. It actually is the blood of Jesus. And if you didn't believe that it was the actual blood of Jesus, then you were not a true Christian. So therefore, as part of their root, what's the shape of the head?
The Pope was not a rocket scientist.
The Pope knew what he was doing. You may not agree with this. But so one of the doubts that actually came into existence in the Christian world, and apparently according to his claims was quite severe, that was that indeed this wine that you're drinking has not really become wine. At most it is a symbol of Jesus' blood, or not even that.
And that's the presumed population.
The population was totally uneducated and was primitive.
The Muslim population.
There's a very strong analog to the Muslim population today. So, his point was that there were serious doubts created in the mentality of the Christian world at that time. And similarly, as far as the wafer is concerned, and also there were doubts as to whether the crucifixion took place or whether Jesus actually arrived. So therefore it became important to them that these hated Jews prove that you use blood, because they actually, as part of the ritual.
Blood is blood.
Blood is really part of the ritual, and they actually sacrificed Christian children in order to obtain this blood, or that they crucified children. I mean, the first case was the case of William of Norwich in 1150, in which some murdered Christian boy was found in the woods, and then it became well believed all over the world that every year Jews have to crucify at least one Christian as a commemoration of the act of crucifixion. And then 100 years later in Germany and Fulda and otherwheres, the blood libel developed, and then the fact that the Jews try to desecrate the host, that is, they try to attack the wafer. Absolutely, the blood libel persists to this day. The blood libel has not disappeared. His point was that this irrational form of anti-Semitism was a consequence of self-doubt on the part of the Christians, and the Pope's edict that you had to actually believe in the fact that the wine was blood was another illustration of a response to that doubt.
Was there a parallel to the idea of the Christian prohibition against
the wine? No, there were certainly Christian objections to this prohibition. They regarded it as being an insult to them that if they touched your wine, you couldn't drink it. So this was certainly an additional source of xenophobic anti-Semitism. But what Professor Langmuir is describing in this book is that there were essentially three such stages to anti-Semitism. First, the xenophobia, which existed in a greater or lesser form, but that existed in antiquity. Then, with the triumph of Christianity, anti-Semitism became part of the religion. You had to hate the Jews precisely because the Christians and the Jews came from the same source. That is, they both believed in the Old Testament, and the fact that the Jews rejected the divinity of Jesus meant that the Christians had to declare the Jews eternally damned and evil as simply part of their religion. But even that was not the irrational anti-Semitism as evinced by Hitler, because they still reacted at least in a religiously fanatic way, but at least to existing Jewish beliefs and characteristics, or at least perhaps greatly distorted, that they represented something. But in the 12th century, two things happened. Jews moved into the money-lending business because they were excluded from all other forms of business, and according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, one of the drives for this was because they had to engage in this legal fiction of being investors in the wine business rather than actual manufacturers. They had to provide capital as bankers rather than as owners. And the second was that a huge amount of Christian self-doubt was emerging because of the changed economic conditions. The economy was static from in Northern Europe, especially from the 6th century until the 10th or 11th century. And with the advent of modernity, in a sense, the towns were being created, social systems were being disrupted, all kinds of serious doubts were emerging within Christianity, which required, for example, the papal bull about the wine actually turning into blood. They had to satisfy their own emotional needs, create this crazy fantasy of the Jew as a ritual drinker of Christian blood and desecrator of the host and the crucifier every year. The international jury comes together to find a victim to crucify, just as they crucified Jesus in the past. So these were events of the 12th century, and they did persist until today. And if this analysis is correct, of course, we're in a lot of trouble because the entire Muslim world at the moment is also engaged in a crisis of not being able to confront modernity, and the same irrational anti-Semitism that developed in the Christian world in the 12th century has been transferred with a great deal of force to the Muslim world of today. Okay, so that's the main thesis of this whole circle of ideas. Okay. So, first of all, where were the main elements of Jewish settlement? And what was the importance of the wine industry? Both of these things are illustrated by this map. Professor Salvage, so I passed out one map last time, but here's another map of what was called Lotharingia, that is the middle kingdom, between the kingdom which was west of the Rhine, which eventually became France, and the kingdom which was east of the Rhine, which eventually became Germany. And the importance of wine was so great that there was this tripartite division. It was the kingdom to the west, the kingdom to the east, and the middle kingdom of Lotharingia, the middle kingdom. But as you can see from the map, when the middle kingdom was created, they still had a little indentation of the Western Kingdom, which moved away from the Rhine, some 70 or 80 kilometers to the east, in order to include such towns as Mainz and Speyer, various wine-producing regions, to be sure that the wine regions were still contained, that the Western Kingdom still had a supply of vineyards along the Rhine. This small. The total population, 3,000 or 4,000 would be my guess. I don't know exactly. The Jewish population is between 300 or 400 families.
300 or 400 families.
Yeah, those were the biggest towns. I'll read from the Encyclopedia Britannica about King Lothair, about over whom this region was named. Lothair, 825 to 869. King of a district called after him Lotharingia, or Lorraine, was the second son of the Emperor Lothair I. On his father's death in 855, he received for his kingdom a district lying to the west of the Rhine, between the North Sea and the Jura Mountains, which was called Regnum Lothari, and in the early 10th century became known as Lotharingia, or Lorraine. On the death of his brother Charles in 863, he added some land south of the Jura to this inheritance. But except for a few feeble expeditions against the Danish pirates, he seemed to have done little for his governance or his defense. The reign was chiefly occupied by efforts on the part of Lothair to obtain a divorce from his wife, Tudeburga, sister of Jucbert, abbot of St. Maurice, and his relations with his uncles Charles the Bald and Louis the German were influenced by his desire to obtain their support for this plan. Although quarrels and reconciliations between the three kings followed each other in quick succession, in general it may be said that Louis favored the divorce and Charles opposed it, while neither lost sight of the fact that Lothair was without male issue. Lothair, whose desire for the divorce was prompted by his affection for a certain Walrada, put away Tathvega, but Huckberg took up arms on her behalf, and after she had submitted successfully to the ordeal of water, Lothair was compelled to restore her in 848. Still pursuing his purpose, he won the support of his brother, the Emperor Louis II, by a cession of lands and obtained the consent of the local clergy to the divorce and to his marriage with Walrada, which was celebrated in 862. A synod of the Frankish bishops met at Metz in 863 and confirmed this decision, but Tathvega fled to the court of Charles the Bald, and Pope Nicholas I declared against the decision of the synod. An attack on Rome by the emperor was without result, and in 865, Lothair, convinced that Louis and Charles at their recent meeting had discussed the partition of his kingdom and threatened with excommunication, again took back his wife. Tathvega, however, either from inclination or compulsion, now expressed her desire for a divorce, and Lothair went to Italy to obtain the assent of the new Pope Adrian II. Facing a favorable interpretation on the words of the Pope, he had set out on a return journey when he received by fever and died at Piacenza on 8th of August 1869. He left by Walralba a son, Hugo, who was declared illegitimate, and his kingdom was divided between Charles the Bald and Louis the German. So the history, of course, as you know, the war is over that region of Alsace and Lorraine from that period until the 20th century have persisted. So the fact that he was unable to obtain the divorce and had his second wife declared legitimate and therefore had the second son declared legitimate had a profound impact on European history for the next 1100 years. Okay. Such is the course of history. Okay. This is yours. So this is mine. Okay. Now, let me read a bit about the importance of wine. For example, the drinking habits. So I'll read in translation. The amount of wine that was drunk during this period can only be measured by measuring cups of Old Melech HaBashan. The canons of St. Paul, for example, who were not considered particularly great drunkards, provided 17 liters of beer a day per person.
Wow.
That's beer?
Yes.
Not wine.
But, what do you mean? How does he what?
I'm out of this.
What?
The 17 years
of the members of the monastery. That was part of the... It was part of
nothing else to do.
That was part of the daily allotment that people had to drink. Well,
they didn't drink
And every monk in the monastery of Battle, who were also regarded as decent people, they were allowed no less, that's what it says in the Latin source, no less than 16 liters of wine a day.
Did they
No, they were drinking it.
It's a lot to drink.
It's a lot to drink, and they were drinking a lot. Maybe you would say that these numbers don't teach us that for the whole about what was happening, the habits of eating and drinking in this ruled land, but rather that drunkenness amongst the Goyim in the Middle Ages was so that it was so widespread that it became the norm even amongst normal people. It's enough to remember that in the Sechet Ta'anit on the Suda HaMafseket, that occurs before the beginning of the fast of Tisha B'Av. According to Rabbi Gamliel, one can eat meat and drink wine, but you have to change a little bit. And Rabbi Yehuda says, how do you change? If you are accustomed to drinking 10 cups of wine, then he would drink only 5. And it's impressive to see what the Balei HaTosfot say on this. According to them, even though Rabbi Gamliel's opinion about eating meat and drinking wine was not accepted, and the halacha was that one is not allowed to eat meat or drink wine in the Sudan on second. Nevertheless, as far as other things are concerned, the laws of Rabban Gamliel apply and you have to change. And this was taken in Ashkenaz and considered to be the halacha by the Ramah. But the Ramah in Krakow in the 16th century preferred a more abstract explanation and not the one that was mentioned in the Brita, but says even in other drinks one lessens it a little bit. The Tosfot, on the other hand, who were living in France in the Middle Ages, did not see in the example of the Brita anything out of the ordinary, and they said simply, and then you have to cut down a little bit on your drinking, that if he was accustomed to drinking 10 cups of beer, then, or from some other drink, one should only drink 5. So a large amount of drinking took place. So the fact is that there was a great amount of drinking taking place during this entire period, and as I mentioned, wine was regarded as the drink. The fact that some of the monks in a certain monastery rebelled against their the father or whatever it's called, the prior of the monastery, because he was forcing them to drink beer, which was insulting rather than drinking wine. And if you had to drink water, you were considered really no better than an animal, because it was certainly not a drink that human beings were fit to drink. So there were basically three choices of drink: wine, beer, or water. And whiskey hadn't yet been invented, and coffee and tea hadn't yet been.
About cognac, which is made from wine.
Yeah, all of these distilled beverages were not available.
Cognac is made from wine.
Yeah, cognac is made from wine, and but still, that was not what was profitable.
Yeah, anything to do with sanitation,
it may very well be that water. It may very well be that water was dangerous, and alcoholic beverages were safe. That's certainly a possibility. Okay. Now, as I mentioned, the Jewish households were small, that is, were isolated. There weren't, and many of the cases which inevitably came up were the fact that you had non-Jewish servants in a house and they came in contact with the wine. It was sort of impossible to run a household, no washing machines, no electric stoves, no refrigerators, no vacuum cleaners. So you needed servants to maintain a household, and many of the times the servants were just simply non-Jewish. Whether the servants were slaves or actual or simply Christian girls who were working in the house as paid workers, nevertheless they were part of the kitchen, and the issue of problems arose. So now I'm going to describe what the situation was prior to Rashi. So I will read again, this time from page 41 of Professor Soloveitchik's book. The accepted distinction between wine with which a guy actually touched and wine that was produced by a guy. From Ashkenaz at this time, they were available a few lines with anonymous lines which shed some light on the position of the scholars and leaders on this issue of the prohibition of obtaining any profit from Stam Yena. They come from a book called Sefer HaOreh, whose meaning is a book of collections, and this collection came from the school of Rashi, and they contain many decisions of the Chachamim of the Rhine Valley in their original form. Decisions from the Rhine Valley which were edited by the students of Rashi, and then actual decisions as well of Rashi himself. For example, you find, from the origin of the one can determine the origin of a particular selection from its content. For example, this is the introduction to the he'll quote Yayin Nesach in the book, in the Sefer HaOleh. Yayin shel Yisrael, shel Nascho Goy, af al pi she'asru chachamim v'hana'a, anan nohagin lizvuni legoyim, mishum shebezman hazeh ein menaschim la'avodah zarah. Miu Yayin Nesach shel Goy, asur b'kuli hai lo makilim. In other words, he's saying that wine that a Jew, that a non-Jew came in contact with, we, even though according to the Gemara it's prohibited, we have to derive any profit from it, any benefit from it, we permit it to derive profit from it, that you can't drink it, but you can sell it, for example, because, but we don't go so far as to allow deriving profit from wine which was non-Jewish wine originally. And the reason for this concession is fairly clear, even without going into the Gemara, which we